Welcome to the Hollywood Outsider, an award-winning weekly entertainment podcast. In this episode, we're only talking about three films. We're talking about Dream Scenario, which is Nick Cage's new movie. We're talking about The Holdovers, which is going to be Oscar bait later on, and Godzilla Minus One.
Is that correct?
Okay.
Equals zero.
Thank you. I keep getting that title so wrong. Let's get on with the show. All right, guys. So you're wondering why we're talking about just free movies is because we wanted to review these films, but we had already recorded and done the next episode, which is the Holiday Spirit Movie Battle Royale. So that'll be coming out in a day or two. But we wanted to get this out because we want to talk about these movies because we also do movie reviews here at the Hollywood Outsider. And that's just how we want to do it. Don't ask so many questions. Yeah. Joining me for this, myself, Aaron Peterson, John Davenport.
Hola, peaches.
Troy Heinrichs.
I don't even know if I'm here right now.
Amanda Sink.
Hello, hello. You've been graced with my presence. Jesus.
Hey, how was that for a catchphrase? Was that a good one?
That was terrible.
Was it? All right.
It's like you can't even decide which language you want to do it in.
No. Yeah.
It's a nice try.
I'll still workshop
Dr.
it.
Dr. Seuss, like snitches. Snitches.
Okay.
Get stitches.
We're not doing any topics or anything for this particular episode, just movie reviews. We will have the Holiday Spirit Movie Battle Royale coming up, like I said, but we're going to start with Dream Scenario. So this is the new Nick Cage movie, but by the way, Troy, you and I are going to talk about Dream Scenario. I got to ask, did you guys hear Nick Cage gave an interview and he said he only wants to do three or four more movies and then he's retiring. He's going to maybe do TV, but he doesn't want to do movies anymore.
Interesting. I did not hear that.
Yeah. Well, his taxes are all paid.
It's fair. Maybe that's why. I think he hasn't watched much television, but his son convinced him to watch Breaking Bad, and he loved the form, the storytelling form of that. And so I think he just wants to try something different.
I mean, if it's the profile, right? Like if you think like James Spader, I mean, he moved from movies to TV and then had a long run on TV between Denny Crane and Fred Reddington.
How did I know that you would find a way to work Blacklist into this?
I never said Blacklist. I said Red Reddington. You said Blacklist.
You don't need to. You did it on your own.
I was talking about James Spader. That has nothing to do with Blacklist.
Dear God, man. Who also has never had the film career that Nick Cage has had. So I don't know if that's a fair comparison, but I understand what you're saying. All right. So let's talk about Dream Scenario. And this is a hapless family man. Paul Matthews is played by Nicolas Cage. He finds his life turned upside down while millions of strangers suddenly start seeing him in their dreams. But when his nighttime appearances take a nightmarish turn, Paul is forced to navigate his newfound stardom in this wickedly entertaining comedy from writer-director Christopher Borgli. And now it's produced by Ari Aster, if you know him from Midsommar and whatnot. Troy, you saw this, and I'm really confused. This sounds like a really intriguing plot, like very being John Malkovich, right? But is it as heady? Is it as smart? Is it intelligent? Is this premise as smart as it sounds, or is it trying too hard? Because I could see it riding that line.
Well, I could tell you that the marketing department is freaking smart.
Okay.
The marketing department put together a pretty freaking awesome trailer. It was funny. It was exciting. It was like, this is going to be the next Everything Everywhere All at Once. I'm super intrigued. Mm-hmm. And then I went to the movie theater and I was like, these sons of bitches.
They got you?
They got me. Because it was not anything like the trailer sold the movie for.
Okay, so, all right. Can you elaborate on that without really ruining it? Can you explain why it's different?
Yeah, I think so. I went into the movie assuming that it was going to be some kind of weird, like, comedy switch to spoof on horror film, like Freddy Krueger-esque.
Because
the
idea
concept.
Is people keep seeing Nicolas Cage in their dreams, and they can't figure out why, right?
Exactly. Okay. Correct. And still trying to figure out why. The big thing that this movie is about, I think, is about Nicolas Cage's character, Paul. That is what the movie is about. It's about his dream scenario. In his dream scenario, he is king shit. He is awesome. He is published. He is everything he wants to be. And it comes down to the fact that he's just not. And I mean, that's really what the movie is about. It's about him trying to navigate his dream scenario life to realize that he doesn't live up to standards, basically.
So if I'm understanding this correctly, he does show up in other people's dreams though, right? That is
for sure.
Okay. But he is pretty much unaccomplished. He wants to be accomplished, but he's very unaccomplished, but he becomes accomplished through other people's dreams, but he can't quite achieve it on his own. Is that
correct? And then as things progress in real life, obviously that's when the dreams take a turn for the different, we'll call it. Some of them are horrific. Some of them are murderous. Some of them are just strange. And so it's like, it's almost like it, the biggest equivalent I could come up with is maybe Colossal with Anne Hathaway.
That's a good movie.
Where like how she feels depends on what the kaiju monster is doing. It kind of feels like that's the scenario that's going on here.
Oh, like the dreams are affected by his inner turmoil.
I think so. Okay. I think that's kind of what I took away from it at the end of the day. But I'll tell you this, Nick Cage is great. He is great in this film. He acts really well. He's funny. He gets angry. I mean, his full range of emotion is right on point. This is probably one of the more interesting since Face Off Nick Cage type movies that I've seen where I've actually enjoyed Nick Cage.
Old words. Yeah.
Yeah. The story just is just weird. It's weird. And I don't know, like,
and you like weird usually. You like unique. You like a little weird.
I'm still like wrestling with if I'm on the like I really hated it because I wasn't what I was sold the bill of goods for, or I really like it because what I got out of the movie I connected with very deeply actually, and I'm like yeah I get what he's going through and I get what's happening and I get what's going on and cancel culture and a bunch of other things that are in this movie, and it's just like, but that's not what I was sold. So do I like the movie? Because I was expecting something totally different.
Okay, so let me ask you that. Let's leap off there. It wasn't what you expected, but you were affected by it. You were deeply affected by it. Why? Why did, does it feel like this is, because how it sounds to me is it's talking about most everyday people, people that have dreams, have aspirations and can't attain them, can't figure out how to achieve their goals, their dreams. And so they have to live with, you're just average.
Yeah.
Is that kind of what it is?
Yeah, it's that. And it's also a matter of the fame that you get because you're showing up in all these people's dreams. And because of the fame, even though you did absolutely nothing wrong, you're basically ostracized for the things that you're not doing. And then because you're not doing them and getting ostracized for it, then you try to fight the system. And because you're fighting the system, bad shit starts happening in real life. Right. So it's a matter of like, where do you draw the line of just accepting who you are versus trying to be something you're not?
I think that sounds really interesting, to be perfectly honest with you.
It is. It is absolutely interesting and fascinating. It's just like, that's not what the movie was that they sold you in the trailer. So if you're going in based on what you see in the trailer of this like really weird, quirky, exciting, it's even in the log line, right? Like this is one of, you know, best comedies. It's not a comedy at all. You laugh really? A few times. There's definitely funny lines in the movie, but it's not a comedy. No, it is a heady piece of how do you deal with life in general and what are you willing to risk to be correct at the end of the day?
That's interesting. So when it came to the end, you know, it sounds like you were all over the place in terms of what you really thought of it. What do you give it? Like if $10 is the full price of admission, what do you give this?
I'm still sitting at a solid 5 because the acting is great. The music is great. The effects are awesome. The story just stops and you're just kind of going like, what at the end?
Really?
So it's just like, I can't say it's good. I can't say it's bad. This is a movie you have to experience for yourself and make your own opinion on. I definitely, like I said, I love Nick Cage. I love the concept. I like the idea. I don't know if you go in expecting one thing and get something else, you might be turned off. If you go in and saying, I'm just here to go on the ride, then you might find something really interesting about it because there's a lot of good conceptual storylines that come out of this that make you go, oh yeah, I should probably think differently about that. And I should probably think differently about that.
Yeah.
That so it definitely good. Is an art. It's an art piece because it's A24. So it definitely makes you think, but I the story just doesn't feel like it was buttoned up.
Interesting. Okay. Well, now let's go into Alexander Payne's The Holdovers.
Yeah, this one is giving you that little bit of a Dead Poet Society vibe. You know, teacher sitting there, he's watching these kids over the holiday break. It's Paul Giamatti. I mean, how can you go wrong, right? you can rent The Holdovers on Amazon Prime Video. It's also in the theaters, So make sure you go ahead and check out The Holdovers. It's from Alexander Payne. It follows a curmudgeonly instructor in a New England prep school who's forced to remain on campus during Christmas break to babysit the handful of students who have nowhere to go, eventually forming an unlikely bond with one of them, a damaged, brainy troublemaker, newcomer Dominic Sessa, and with the school's head cook, who has just lost a son in Vietnam. So if you like with Honors and these types of movies, I think this is that place where you get this bonding moment, a father-son type moment. What did you think of Paul Giamatti's performance and this newcomer in Dominic Sessa?
Well, Paul Giamatti is always great. I feel like, you know, it kind of goes without saying, but you should still say it, because I don't know if really people appreciate him as much as an actor as they should. I don't think I've ever seen a bad Paul Giamatti performance. I've definitely seen a performance where the director didn't understand the tone that was going on in the movie, so he seemed off, but I feel like he delivers in everything he does. And here he is a very curmudgeonly instructor. Like he's somebody who works at a prep school, and he kind of looks down on his students because he feels like they don't appreciate their privilege. They've kind of taken advantage of the privilege that they have because they're all from rich families and they're all just getting that free pass. And he refuses to give one. He refuses to, because their dad is a massive donor, he's not going to give a student a pass. And he's very stern in his morality and his beliefs, and he's very devout in that, much to the school's chagrin. And Giamatti plays with that. And he also plays wonderfully. You know, he's funny. He's dramatic. He's serious. He's all over the place. But he also has very powerful moments where he won't tolerate anyone talking down to Mary, who's played by Divine Joy Randolph, because he has nothing but love and respect for her. He just finds her to be a very good person who does everything for these kids. And they just, you know, sometimes get a little smarmy and whatnot. He has just a up and down a hill of emotions throughout the film, and he plays them beautifully. Now, the other thing I would say is I expected that from Paul Giamatti, but Dominic Sessa is a new actor. I mean, I think this is his first performance ever, and he plays Angus Tully, who's the kid of one of these rich parents, and these rich parents basically just abandon him on Christmas. And he's angry. And we find out why he's so angry as the film goes, because you kind of have to see more of his story to understand. And you also get Paul Hunnam, who's Paul Giamatti's character. You get his understanding of, okay, maybe I'm not being fair. Maybe these kids have more going on with them than I ever give them credit for. And it's just like this nice balance. And it only works because Giamatti and Sessa have a wonderful back and forth that builds into a real relationship as the film goes. So those two are wonderful together. They really, really click.
What about the time period? I mean, the trailer makes us feel like it's set in the late 70s, early 80s.
Set in 1970. Yep.
Do you feel like that plays into it? Like the things that are going on in the world at that time? Does that add any element to this particular film?
Not really. I really don't think that the time period adds a lot other than there's definitely a mental health component, and there's a lack of understanding of mental health. I'm not going to say any more about that. I think they needed to have a setup where you don't have cell phones kind of interfering. You know, you need that lack of communication, so you can't get instant communication with people, because that's kind of pivotal to some story elements. I think that's a factor for why it's in the 70s.
And does the prep school really give it that Ivy League feel? Oh, yeah. Or do you feel like this could have been set in anywhere middle America?
No. As soon as you meet the kids, you want to punch most of them. Yep. It definitely feels very, very Ivy League. And I should say, all of the acting, I want to go back to Divine Joy Randolph. Her character of Mary is this woman who is basically in charge of the cooks at the school. And she has this job. She had it to put her son through school and then eventually college, and to just be the success that she knew he could be. And then he dies in Vietnam. She has a story of her own that is just very, very beautiful and tragic. So, I mean, all the performances kind of connect, and they really, really do come together. Back to your question. Yes, it does feel like a prep school. There is no moment where I don't feel like these kids are kind of assholes, but also maybe we're just not being as understanding as we could be. Maybe they're not as bad as we think they are.
Well, if this is a movie that rivals all the things that we've grown up with in our age, as far as school movies go, Hoosiers with honors and that type of stuff. Where does this one fit? $10 full price of admission. What are you giving the holdovers?
I give this $8.50. I think this is a great movie. It's a really, really beautiful movie. It's a holiday movie. I would actually call this a Christmas film. It's very much a Christmas film. Yeah, because it takes place around the holidays. It's really themed against family and acceptance and, you know, your family isn't necessarily blood and a lot of other things. You know, it's just very well timed. I think it's one of Alexander Payne's better films. He's very much an up and down director for me. I like him. I don't like him. You know, this is a great movie. And it reminds me, the way that I would phrase it is, it's Uncle Buck for the holidays. You know, it kind of has a lot of the Uncle Buck vibe where, you know, you have this guy, he doesn't really want to be there, but he's going to handle it because that's his duty. And then he comes to have a much deeper understanding for one in particular kid in this case, but he has a much deeper understanding and wants to do better, and he wants this kid to do better. And I think all that stuff really, really comes together well by the time the film ends. I mean, it's a beautiful story, I thought.
Nice.
Yep. Okay. Now from there, we're going to segue. And I had no idea we were going to talk about this other than the fact that one of our hosts is obsessed with the character, but it's Godzilla Minus One. This is a movie that is somehow taking theaters by storm. I don't understand it. It actually... it's the largest opening for a foreign film this year, this past weekend, which is why we're like, we got to add this to the mix. And then everybody freaking saw it, except I think Troy's the only one that hasn't seen this, right?
I have not.
What the hell? I don't understand. This is a $15 million Godzilla movie. Mm-hmm. Now, you go see Godzilla versus Kong, and that was $150 million or whatever it costs. You see the sequel, it's probably $200 million. We don't know. This is $15 million. And I got to tell you, special effects wise, well, you know what? I'll hold that. Let me tell you. This takes place in World War II, or right after World War II. You're dealing with the aftermath of World War II, and I assume you know what I mean by that. You know, there's a couple bombs that were dropped. And the Japanese people are dealing with the ramifications of this. Like, it's a really horrible setup. It's kind of emotional. I would honestly say, and I'm sure no one's going to agree with me, but I think they handled this particular scenario better than Oppenheimer. Just saying, whatever, you take it how you want. Anyway, so they're dealing with the aftermath of World War II and you know, the bombs that dropped when they find out that they have another foe to deal with. And that's Godzilla. And he is, he's coming back. They don't know when, they don't know where, but he's coming back. And they are led by a character that has really, really struggled to be heroic. He has failed to be a hero twice before, and now Godzilla is coming back again. So they have to figure out, how do we take down Godzilla, this massive, massive dinosaur that has this badass fire breathing thing. And let's just go from there. So John, number one, why do you love Godzilla so much?
There's a lot of things that I loved through most of my life, which is like Star Wars, which is something that's fallen off as far as how much I love it. Transformers, it shows up and it leaves. I can think of several other things that I've loved, but nothing has ever gotten me excited as much as Godzilla. I think it's because of the connection that I have to my older brother when it comes to watching it. But also there's just something about Godzilla that really means movie magic to me, you know, especially way back then when you've got a guy running around in an obvious rubber suit. Today it feels ridiculous, but back then it was the bee's knees of what filmmaking was, at least in my wee little brain. And the character has gone through different incarnations. You have what we have here, which is more of a force of nature Godzilla. And this is more akin to the very first Godzilla movie, or even Godzilla Rides Again. Very much akin to especially the very first Godzilla movie, which is an allegory to something as far as related to the time in which it's told. Or you have the anti-hero Godzilla, or you have the benevolent Godzilla, or you've got, you know, there's so many different incarnations of him over the years, and he fits in every single aspect. And to me, he just means joy. You know, it's always a lot of fun.
Okay, well, the lead pilot that I was talking about that's never heroic, his name, Shikishima, is his name.
Shikishima, Koshi Shikishima.
Right. And he's trying to build a family with Noriko, who is this young woman that is also, she found a child that was abandoned, and now they're basically trying to raise it, and there's some complicated family dynamics. So, Amanda, you actually saw this and loved it, and I never expected to hear that from you, but you said the characters really are even more interesting than Godzilla was. So, John just said why he loves Godzilla. Why did you love the characters more than Godzilla?
You know, and I feel like we've talked with the other modern Godzilla franchise that's out and about right now. We've talked about how it has struggled at times to find a good balance between the characters and the monsters and all that good stuff. And this, I feel like, was the perfect balance where Godzilla is a monster causing chaos and destruction. He's still a main character. But we also then have these supplemental characters that we get to focus on and watch their story write out. And it never feels like one overshadows the other. There's a really sweet balance in this one. And the story that they tie into it just tugs on your heartstrings, you know, especially by the end. And I don't know, I guess I just wasn't expecting that, because for this one, I felt like it would be so much focus on just the catastrophe and trying to get Godzilla taken down, very Jaws-like and experience. But I don't know. I think it was because it surprised me how much it connected with me in some ways. Like, it's not like it's an experience I've ever been through, obviously. So I don't know. I think there was just something kind of special about it.
I would actually agree to a lot of that. And I would actually push this so far to say that you can almost subtract Godzilla out of this movie.
Easy, and boss.
Hold on.
Okay.
And put any other sort of like disaster slash any sort of, you know, monster or something like that. And just which would allow you to focus on the interpersonal stories that are happening here. And it would be almost as good, if not just as good, of a movie. You know, you don't need Godzilla for this movie. And that's kind of nice to a degree because of the story, especially with the specific story they're telling here. They're telling a story about PTSD here. They're telling a story about worth and value and self-worth. And it's not necessarily a story of, it's kind of actually shrouded in this story of a monster that you have to save your country from, but it's more about the interpersonal aspects of it.
Yeah, one thing that I found fascinating, and I'll be honest, I didn't want to see it at all, because I just outside of the modern American versions of Godzilla, I just don't care about the character that much. It's just not a character I really get into. It's nothing against it. Just don't get into it that much. I like Kong better, I guess. But I had heard
you're a nationalist.
Maybe. I had heard you guys like raving about it. I'm like, okay, I'm curious. I'd seen a lot of great reviews and said that, you know, the characters are probably the human characters here are better than anything that's existed in the monsterverse in the American side. Which I thought was a big statement, right? That's a pretty bold statement, especially with Monarch out, and I think Monarch's been doing a pretty good job with human characters. So I went and checked it out, and I have to agree. I even though I think the last third of the movie I pretty much predicted everything that happened, it didn't matter because I was invested in the characters and invested in the plight, and I was really hoping to see certain things, even though I kind of knew what the things were going to be. I wanted to see them and hope that they delivered. And the relationship between Shikishima and Noriko, I thought was a beautiful relationship. I think those characters work together wonderfully. It's really interesting to me to see a monster movie put more emphasis and more care in constructing fully realized characters, and even the supporting characters are all fully realized, than they did the monster attacks. Like, there are long portions where there is no monster, and unlike every other monster movie I've watched in the last few years, I didn't care. And I think that's a big statement for a movie like this. I was good with spending time with them, you know, and what they were going through and their struggles. And, you know, especially how Shikishima is really struggling with his cowardice. and really presenting that in an honest way and explaining why maybe you're not as bad as you think you are. Like maybe there's some reasoning behind his cowardice and that is understandable by much degree. I just found that to be fascinating. Now, Amanda, you talked about the Jaws aspect. I agree. I call this Jawzilla a lot of times when I'm explaining it to people, because very much I feel like the story follows a very Godzilla-like formula, which is you have a monster, they have to come together and figure out how to defeat it, and even some of the tactics felt very, very much like how they accomplished this with Jaws, and I'm not going to spoil any of those things, but there's even rafts. There's even inflatable rafts to some degree. What the hell? Other than one scene where I'm like, how is he standing there? Because he's supposed to be
100%
way above the water. Like, how the fuck is he just standing 100%. There? That's the only dumb thing. I really think it's a really dumb thing. Other than that, I think this is a pretty clever construct. Why did you like this construct, or did it work for you, I guess?
Well, I think I liked it because of what I was talking about a little bit earlier, the balance between having this big monster creature trying to just, I don't know, walk around, I guess, but causing mayhem, and clearly has very selective ability to choose who he's going to kill and who he doesn't kill. But I think it was fun, but it was also because I started to care about these characters and what they were going through and how the situation made them feel. It was there was such a great analogy between war and what people are dealing with Godzilla coming into town. Yeah. And so I think because of that, and you really care about these characters, and you wonder like, oh, what's going to happen, or is this going to happen, and you know, how are they going to move past this? I bought into their stories, and I think when you add that element of how it is synonymous with war, it makes you feel it on an even deeper level, and that catastrophe and what that actually means for the people who are there. And there were parts that were kind of brutal. I was like, holy crap, I cannot believe that this is, you know, being shown as part of this Godzilla movie. And I don't know, it was also kind of fun to see them work through the different ideas of how they were going to take him down in a way that for the most part was like, okay, I can plausibly see this happening, I guess. Like, this is what most people would probably say, here's, let's try this idea. And trying to get him down. But I will definitely agree, the dumbest thing that they have is apparently he has like little motors on his feet to keep him afloat.
For people that don't, and this isn't really much, this isn't a spoiler, but there's a scene where he's in the ocean and he's supposed to be obviously in a very, very deep part of the ocean, but somehow he's just standing there.
Jesus.
Yeah, he's Jesus. He's just walking on water. It's a weird choice, but it is what it is.
I did see this one like meme, like people were trying to figure this out on Twitter, and somebody was like, maybe he just like, you know how he has that laser that will go up? He could just like, maybe it comes out of his butt or something, and that keeps him above.
Whatever makes it easy to understand, for sure. Uh-huh. So Johnny, you love Godzilla. You followed him your whole life. This is very much a return to form in respect to, this is a monster movie. I have gotten kind of really tired of every American Godzilla movie kind of painting him as a hero in some way. He's not. In this movie, he's back to being, he is very much like Jaws. He is just wanton destruction for no reason whatsoever. And if he's coming, you should all be frightened. And I love that return to form. Did you, as a longtime Godzilla fan?
I've loved every incarnation of Godzilla there has been, whether he is that force of nature, whether he is that malevolent guardian, whether he's just an anti-hero, every single version of Godzilla there's been, I've appreciated, because, you know, he's Godzilla and he's awesome. This is very much like the original 1954 Godzilla story. So the only difference is that story was more about the atomic age and how we are entering the atomic age. And this story is more about, well, it's got a couple of different things to it, doesn't it? It talks more about mental health. It talks more about self-value. It talks more about how people see us or what is expected of us as patriots. Those sorts of stories is what this really covers the most. And I appreciated those stories on top of appreciating what I got to see in the way of Godzilla. I do have some minor foibles when it comes to some of the graphical elements or some of the such imagery. As? Okay,
that's
so
what
I don't
mind. Supposed to be, man. Full context.
Yeah. Well, I don't mind. I don't mind the idea that he was kind of sitting there in the water and he's quasi, looks like he's standing there in the water. It's, you know, you can play that off with he's flapping his tail underneath the water and that's how he's holding himself up. That's how dolphins do it and everything else. So whatever. I don't mind that aspect of it.
Okay.
The parts when he's on land, there's parts where he is this wildly animated and very well done CG creature moving around and interacting with the background, and it looks great, and it should look great. The director Takashi Yamazaki had a visual effects background, and much like Gareth Edwards, when he was unhappy with the way the visual effects were working out, he stepped in and he started doing them himself. My one problem with it is that if you're not paying attention, you won't notice this if you're not paying attention to Godzilla in the background of images or what's going on when you're looking at one of the other characters and you see Godzilla in the background. He's very stiff in those moments. He looks, I couldn't help but think about a video game monster when the video game monster is way down the street and it's just moving and you're supposed to be kind of worried about it, where it's just like kind of bopping up and down the street as if it's walking, but it's not really doing anything scary. It's just supposed to be a menacing figure in the background. That's what I kind of felt like this was, where it was almost triggering Uncanny Valley with the way he moved, because it didn't feel very natural until you had him in full camera and he's moving his arms again and he's moving his head around again and he's doing things and he's just much more of an animated creature. He looked really great then. So it's a little bit of a mixed bag for me visually, but overall I loved it.
Okay, well, I want to continue on that thread. So Amanda, what did you think about the effects? Because I will tell you, there's a scene that's about probably the major scene about halfway through the movie where, you know, there's an attack in the water, which I thought was phenomenal, honestly. And some of the effects in here, I am so impressed. For a $15 million movie, it looks better than a lot of what Godzilla versus Kong. I got to be honest, this Godzilla looks way cooler than Barbenheimer. The Barbenheimer freaking Godzilla, Barbenzilla, that's out there, where he's like all laced up with pink and ready to rock in the new Godzilla versus Kong trailer. I think he looks cooler here. There are moments where I'm like, well, that definitely looks like the old 50s Godzilla. It's almost like a throwback. But for the majority of the film, I think this looks fabulous. Amanda, you've heard John's take. What's yours?
Yeah, I will say one of the things that I enjoyed the most, aside from the relationships and the dynamics there, is the effects. The effects surprised me because I've always kind of felt like Godzilla looks very... I don't know.
Rubber monster running around Tokyo?
Yeah, definitely. And I agree to some extent with John's point that, you know, there are times where he looks stiff, but I think that's just because he's a big boy. He's chonky, you know? He's a chonky boy. So I don't have any judgment or critique when it comes to that. I think that there was a lot that was stellar about it. There were a couple of shots, where the cinematography was like, wow, that was beautiful. I really, really enjoyed that. And some of those happened, you know, obviously without Godzilla even being there. So I really enjoyed all of that. It was one of the things that stood out the most to me. So I'm actually surprised John didn't love it like we did, Aaron.
Well, I think he still loved it.
I still loved it.
He's a graphic designer. He's an artist. He's just nitpicking. A little nitpicking. Yeah,
I still loved it.
Fair enough. Okay,
yeah.
Good.
Yeah, no, I still loved every bit of it. Like, especially him chasing the boats in the water. Oh, my God.
There's a lot. And when he's on land, and there's a whole train sequence that I thought was beautifully handled. And I'm serious, the whole time I'm watching it, I know the budget in my head. And I know when I watch a movie and I know what the budget is going into it, I'm always looking at that. Even when it's $200 million, I'm like, where'd $200 million? Like, I watch Killers of the Flower Moon. Where'd $200 million go? Did Martin Scorsese just snort it? I don't understand. Like, here, wherever
they pay for DiCaprio's hookers,
probably. Here, wherever that money went, it was well spent. It was right. just well spent because it's absolutely. Obvious they don't waste money in Japan. You know, they don't get fancy trailers or anything else. They get, you get what you get, and you get the movie made because it looked great. It looks great. It looks like a $100 million movie. It really does. It does.
Yeah. And I honestly, you say the budget, I had no idea the budget going into the movie. I would have never, ever guessed that it was a $15 million budget.
Yeah. I mean, even Creator had an $80 million budget. And, you know, this by far beats, well, it gets pretty close to that.
I really like this better than Creator. If it makes you feel any better.
Okay.
Just saying. The only thing I didn't like is story-wise, the last act, I literally called everything that happened.
Oh, yeah.
And I did in the first act. That's the only thing that I would... I literally said to my wife exactly how it's going to end. And it happened. I was like, wow, shit.
I'm sure she enjoyed that.
I think she saw it coming, too. And to me, though, that's an important aspect of a great film from a good film, is if you can still have predictable shit, if it's entertaining, if it's done well. Because most movies are not, you know, recreating the wheel. And a Godzilla movie sure isn't, but they did a wonderful job with making me care about characters, putting it in a scenario where I felt something. I mean, they really, really make you feel for how these characters feel in this situation before Godzilla is even really a factor.
Mm-hmm.
It's very impressive. So Godzilla Minus One, if $10 full price of admission, John, what do you give this big boy?
This is going to be kind of shocking, but I'm going to have to give it $8.
I figured it would be a 20, honestly. So, a little shocking.
I'll never live that down.
Amanda, what about you?
I'm going $8, too. I was between $8 and $8.50, but I'm trying to be more conservative in my dollars when it comes to reviews these days.
You're not actually spending it. It's totally
okay. I know, but...
These days, you've been missing for like 16 weeks. What are you talking about?
That's... You know what? I don't want to hear your shit right now.
Okay. I will concede. $8 sounds about right. This is
all right. Okay.
And it's better than Godzilla versus Kong. Even I really like that one, but I think this is a better overall movie.
Well, yeah. I mean, Godzilla versus Kong is a good Godzilla movie. This is a great movie.
Yeah. It's just a great movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, guys, that's going to do it for this particular episode. But tune back in later this week or, you know, after this episode, we're also going to do our Holiday Spirit Movie Battle Royale. So that's coming out soon. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Go to thehollywoodoutsider.com. You can find all of our episodes there and on your favorite podcast app. That's going to do it. Remember, the next time you go to the theater to see any of these three films, buy popcorn.